Why does skipping your morning workout feel less like a missed appointment and more like a moral failing? We've entered an era where health isn't just about avoiding disease, it's become the primary measure of whether you're a good person. This cultural shift has transformed wellness from personal choice into moral obligation, creating what we might call the wellness syndrome, a condition where feeling good equals being good, and anything less marks you as morally suspect. Consider the modern university student signing wellness contracts that promise substance-free living and holistic health practices. What was once a time for experimentation has become a period of rigorous self-optimization. This extends far beyond campus. Corporate wellness programs now track employees' sleep patterns and penalize those who don't meet health metrics, while social media transforms every meal into an opportunity for virtue signaling or self-reproach. This represents a fundamental shift in how we judge human worth. Smokers and overweight people aren't merely seen as unhealthy, but as moral failures threatening society's well-being. When we fail to achieve mandated wellness, we blame ourselves rather than examining the systems that make us sick. This self-blame manifests everywhere. Guilt over skipped workouts, anxiety about food choices, shame over inadequate sleep. We've created what philosophers call biomorality, a system where your body's condition reflects your soul's state, and self-improvement becomes a moral responsibility that trumps all others. When happiness coaches Lynn Rosen and John Liddick, hosts of the Pursuit of Happiness radio show, committed suicide together, they exposed a fundamental paradox. We outsource our most intimate life decisions to wellness experts while bearing total responsibility for our well-being. The $2 billion life coaching industry employs over 45,000 professionals worldwide, all selling vague commands: be happy, nurture your body, manifest abundance. Today's ideal human must embody opposing virtues simultaneously. The aspirational figures flooding your feed are free-spirited yet rigorously disciplined, environmentally conscious yet enthusiastically consumption-oriented, perpetually connected while maintaining authentic presence. They practice mindfulness between meetings, eat organic fast food, and maintain work-life balance while being available 24/7. Corporate meditation programs, now standard from Google to Goldman Sachs, exemplify how ancient spiritual practices have been repurposed to optimize workers rather than provide genuine insight. These programs promise increased productivity while conveniently shifting responsibility for workplace stress onto individuals rather than addressing toxic environments. Your anxiety isn't a product of systemic conditions, it's a personal deficiency requiring self-improvement. Investment bankers working 120-hour weeks exemplify our dysfunctional relationship with the body. They initially treat their flesh as an enemy to productivity, overcoming biological limits through willpower. By year four, their bodies fight back with rage episodes and injuries until survivors learn to treat them as trusted friends requiring careful management. This pattern extends beyond finance into medicine, law, and routine service jobs. Corporations now reframe executives as corporate athletes, requiring training for ideal performance states. Over half of large U.S. employers spend $6 billion annually on wellness programs, diet counseling, on-site gyms, treadmill desks, transforming every moment into potential productivity. At Swedish truck manufacturer Scania, the 24-hour employee concept extends corporate control beyond working hours through fitness facilities and invasive health talks, probing eating and exercise habits. Many employees embrace these programs as unemployment insurance. Staying fit maintains employability. The Protestant work ethic has become the workout ethic. Dieting culture intertwines guilt with pleasure. Many dieters seek relief through regimens like the 5-2 diet, hoping fasting will break the comfort eating and guilt cycle, yet 33% report feeling guiltier afterward. Reality television completes this picture by portraying working-class people as beyond governance, excessively loud, drunk, bodies out of control, providing middle-class viewers a spectacle of moral failure, confirming their own virtue. After losing his job in 2009, Chris Dancy turned to extreme self-tracking, monitoring everything from pulse to REM sleep to toilet habits. If you can measure it, someone will, and that somebody should be you, he explains. Dancy exemplifies the quantified self movement that promises self-knowledge through numbers, not Socrates' philosophical examination, but a market-driven reconfiguration of the self as product. Affordable wearables have fueled explosive growth. Enthusiasts track sleep, heart rate, moods, and environmental factors, sharing findings at show and tells, revealing intimate bodily details. One entrepreneur described his life logging as running a startup, constantly analyzing performance metrics, embodying the ideal neoliberal agent who sees herself simultaneously as employee, product, manager, and entrepreneur. Corporations have enthusiastically embraced these technologies. Hedge fund GLG Partners tracks traders' sleep and diet, then offers coaching to improve routines. The Chicago Teachers Union was forced to accept contracts requiring members to share biometric data or face 600 penalties. This represents what philosopher Gilles Deleuze called societies of control, where work-life boundaries dissolve and surveillance becomes omnipresent yet packaged as personal empowerment. The paradox? Self-trackers willingly submit to authoritarian techniques while protesting government surveillance, ignoring corporations like Google and Facebook that collect vast personal data. Martin Seligman, positive psychology's leading figure, advocates moving from +2 to +7 in your life, treating happiness as amplifiable through willpower. This approach has deep American roots in Calvinism's self-examination emphasis and the mid-1800s New Thought movement, presenting humans as divine creatures with infinitely powerful minds. Norman Vincent Peale's 1952 bestseller, The Power of Positive Thinking, brought these ideas mainstream, particularly appealing to struggling salesmen. Though Seligman claims scientific superiority over Peale's cheap approach, both share the fundamental belief that happiness is ultimately individual choice. When journalist Barbara Ehrenreich questioned his happiness equation, Seligman proved evasive, reluctantly admitting components would decompose into 20 different things, revealing his supposedly scientific approach's shaky empirical foundation. British Prime Minister David Cameron's 2010 announcement to measure national well-being came during student protests and economic recession. Cameron framed happiness as complementing economic priorities, an attitude empowering people to change situations without government support. Cutting benefits becomes not punishment, but motivation to transform passive overweight blobs into resilient entrepreneurs. The fundamental assumption that happiness causes productivity rather than vice versa drives business-oriented happiness research, despite methodological flaws. Modern society has shifted from prohibition to mandatory enjoyment, creating a moral imperative to pursue happiness without delay. Illness can bring unexpected pleasure. Writer Karl Ove Knausgård broke his collarbone during football and discovered unlikely enjoyment lying on the sofa watching Italian football, something he'd only done once in 4 years of parenting. Web developer Rob Lucas writes that illness becomes almost willed, a holiday that the body demands for itself. The fat acceptance movement frames weight discrimination as a civil rights issue, successfully campaigning against discriminatory billboards and supporting legal protections. Yet, paradoxically, advocates often embrace other wellness values, being outgoing, hardworking, and adventurous, while rejecting only the slim body ideal. Barebacking, gay men having condomless sex, directly challenges wellness ethics. This subculture includes bug chasers seeking HIV infection and gift givers knowingly transmitting it. Emerging partly as reaction to AIDS epidemic respectability politics, this practice deliberately rejects the fantasy of the potentially immortal, well-maintained body. Writer Zadie Smith's essay Joy explores the rare, uncontrollable emotion that presupposes surprise and elation, so intense she's experienced it only 5 or 6 times. She recalls dancing on ecstasy at London's Fabric Club. We gave ourselves over to joy. Nearby club Morning Glory now offers wellness culture's sanitized alternative. No drugs or alcohol, just early morning dancing for city workers before work. Even rebellion must now serve productivity. Escaping the wellness syndrome means abandoning obsessive self-monitoring and rejecting limitless potential. We're defined by limitations, not just capabilities. What makes life worthwhile often includes pain. Truth brings misery, political action involves danger, beauty contains sorrow, and love tears us apart. The wellness industry ignores that growth comes through struggle, meaningful connections arise from shared vulnerability, and joy's rarity makes it precious. We've forgotten what it means to be human, messy, contradictory, and beautifully imperfect. Your worth isn't measured in steps taken or calories counted. The most radical act might be the simplest, accepting that sometimes you're tired, sometimes you're sad, and sometimes a slice of cake is just a moment of being alive, not a moral failure or data point. Instead of dwelling on our own sickness, we should address the sickness of the world. To reclaim your humanity is to embrace your limitations, find meaning in struggle, and recognize that true joy cannot be tracked, optimized, or sold.